Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community, will be speaking with our co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law, and Greg Glazer, attorney at law from California. Today is November 10th, 2011. Thanks to all of our listeners. I have opened the chat, so if you have popped in via Facebook, Twitter, or have received an email notification or read any of our blogs, I'm very happy that you have joined us today. We're going to be talking with our co-hosts about particular information regarding vaccinations and your rights in the United States, and in particular, a brand new article written by co-host Greg Glazer on naturalnews.com entitled "Potential Loophole in Vaccine Law Could Mandate Vaccines in Children During Declared Emergency." So this is probably information most everybody needs to know in the case of pandemics or things that are happening in emergency situations. And I would like to welcome our guests, but first I want to mention that on Monday evening we have Grant Bentley teaching about facial analysis and homeopathy. That's at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Last week, we had Kate Birch, a specialist in vaccine health and also epidemic contagious disease, speak with us on as a special guest. So that is in the archives for you to listen to. On Wednesdays, when Dr. Adil is available from India, he speaks about cardiology, heart health, and how he has a clinic using homeopathy to help heal these patients. Of course, Thursday we have Vaccine in Our Rights, and right after this show at 1 p.m., Dr. Christina Chambreau will be talking about pet health and homeopathy. And every so often, I also do a meditation on Sunday evening at around 11:30 at night. So we have quite a few shows going on. So people are probably waiting to just get going here. Please invite friends to listen in. We have a whole full hour show. Okay. Greg, have you called in from California? And I know that you have a fantastic website, www.civilactionnetwork.org, and you are the founder of the Civil Action Network, an independent media organization offering coordinated citizens referenda to promote justice, liberty, and sustainable living.
Yes. Thanks for the plug.
Okay, and why don't you give a plug to our regular weekly co-host, Alan. Alan, okay.
Good afternoon, Debbie. I'm here too. I think we're all here, more or less.
Yeah.
Greg has initiated a number of wonderful different research projects and programs and initiatives, and Greg, we ought to take an hour out sometime just to let you tell us about all of those. But the ones we wanted to talk to today, and Greg had said he wanted to discuss the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act. We've talked a little bit about that in the past, but Greg has some new and more in-depth information for us to get into today. And I think probably, if I'm not mistaken, Greg, that'll dovetail nicely with or interact with your recent article, which raises some very disturbing prospects, but as always with Greg, well researched and analyzed. And so let's dive into this. Where should we start today, Greg?
Yeah, that sounds good. Thank you. Let's start with the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act. Now, this is a document that was drafted in 2001, and it's a federally funded project, and it relates to the health powers, like the public health powers of the government in an emergency. And it was drafted by the Center for Law and Public Health at Georgetown and Johns Hopkins. You know, and again, this is a federally funded project, so they're getting their money from the government. And it's, according to my research, it's very much sponsored by the powers that be, like military backing, because it grants immense powers to the government, including local health boards, but also the federal government, to pass public health measures ad hoc as they go. So during an emergency, imagine there's a bioterrorism event, and the governor of your state declares that there's a public health emergency. Well, once that happens, this triggers the provisions of whatever your state's emergency health laws are. And so the act that we're going to be talking about today, which is the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act, is this proposed law that was put out by this federally funded organization trying to say, okay, we want every state to pass this law. And so this proposed law has gotten a lot of criticism from health freedom advocates and property rights advocates and gun rights advocates as well. And so the first thing I'd like to do is talk a little bit about the background of it. Who drafted this proposed law, and what were the circumstances around its drafting? And
yeah, interestingly, there's a website for the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act, and it says at the top of this, the Centers for Law and the Public Health, a collaborative at Johns Hopkins and Georgetown Universities. But now, if I understand from our recent off-air conversation, Greg, this may not really have been so much a collaborative. Did I understand that correctly, or could you elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah. When they passed the first, when they submitted for public review the first version of this proposed law, the author of it, who's an attorney at Johns Hopkins, he said that it was in collaboration with several organizations, and that actually turned out not to be true. And then in the later draft, he ended up having to revoke that and revise that. The guy's name is Lawrence Gostin, and he comes from he worked on Hillary Clinton's healthcare task force, and he has a background in AIDS medicine and civil rights. And essentially, he's like a he's a very indoctrinated individual who's promoting the military-industrial complex agenda. And this model law was passed during the anthrax scare, and it was it came out right after September. It was published after September 11th, but it actually was accepted for publication in March of that year. So like it was already done, but they just waited for 9/11 to present it to the public.
I have to jump in, if I may, and ask you a question here, and it may be speculative, but do you think it's coincidental, the timing of this? Because when I was looking at this myself at an earlier time, I was of the impression that it was sort of put out publicly or formally maybe December of 2001, sometime, you know, very shortly after 9/11. And the timing of it just seemed, you know, whether coincidental or not, there was the opportunity for this act to sort of ride the wave of fear, because the CDC was then, if I'm not mistaken, was then pushing this on states, trying to get states to enact some part or as much of this model act as they could. And maybe we should point out at least, or I'll speak for myself here, but I feel surely that Greg, that you and Debbie both would probably agree, at least generally, that the content of this model act, which is proposed law for all the states, in many parts and places is very aggressive and overreaching. It would, if and to the extent enacted in individual state laws, would give powers to the states that many people anyway feel is excessive, more than is necessary to address the underlying needs, and just overreaching. And so it's a concern for those of us who value bodily autonomy, integrity, and you mentioned also property rights, although I'm not as familiar with that part of it. But what do you think about the timing of this in terms of its coming out?
I can speak directly to that. When it was first presented, it brought this big uproar from several groups, like the health freedom groups, and then they ended up revising it and then putting it out, just as you said, Alan, in December of 2001. And they just basically changed a little bit of language and just basically paid lip service. Like before, it said to control people, and then they changed it to protect people, and then to control property, and then they changed it to manage property.
Oh, wait, we accidentally said what we meant. We meant to cover that up.
Exactly. And so, which isn't surprising. I mean, when you look at where this is coming from, it's coming from Johns Hopkins and Georgetown, from a federally funded project. The goal is to increase the power of these public health bodies and consolidate power. And so I'm reading through this document, and I've highlighted so much, and it's just there's no way we can cover it in an hour, but I'm going to highlight the main points. And so let's start with that now. Okay.
Right.
So here, let's go through 11 points, or 10. Let's just go through 10 points of the of this proposed law, and I'm going to summarize the points rather than. And if you guys have any questions, just raise it, and then we'll go to the specific code. But I'm just going to summarize what this code says. Okay. So it forces individuals who are suspected of harboring an infectious disease to undergo medical examinations. It means they can force a medical test on you. Okay. They can track and share your personal health information.
Can I stop you at each point with a comment or question? Or
definitely.
Okay. I'm sorry. Would you repeat your very first one, because my thought was a little bit slow in coming. It came in the middle of your reading the second one, but I thought I would try and catch it.
Yeah.
So under the
Model Act, it says that you can, or that the government can force an individual to submit to medical testing.
Now, is there any elaboration in there on what would be grounds for that suspicion, or is that just totally up to the under the model law anyway? Totally up to the local health official to decide who is suspected of having been exposed to a disease and therefore needs a treatment or inspection or what have you.
There's some protection. There's procedural due process protections that are stated at the end of the proposed law. But again, these are lip service. And in regards to what constitutes a significant risk justifying a medical examination, the proposed law has all these definitions at the beginning of it that specify, what's a contagious disease and what's a public health threat and so forth.
Right, and what's a medical examination, or is that something, again, that would just be up to the health official?
Yeah, it is definitely highly in their discretion to determine what constitutes. Originally, there has to be a declaration by the governor, and so it's like they define each bioterrorism has its own definition, and contagious disease has its own definition. And so once these definitions are triggered, and in order to trigger them, it just requires a declaration by the public authority. Like you could have, the public authority could be the local public health authority in St. Louis could say, well, we have a contagious disease threat in St. Louis, And so if that were the case, then that triggers the testing provisions under this proposed law, and then the officials in St. Louis, which would include, your local police officers, your local health boards, they can activate hospitals to be basically agents of the government, and there's even a whole section on that deals with the cooperation of interagency powers.
And I just want to stress one point for the benefit of listeners that and you've already said this perhaps a few times in different ways, but just to clarify that what we're talking about here is that there can be radically different rights under once an emergency is declared,
mm-hmm.
from times when there is no emergency declared and we're dealing with only routine, for purposes of immunizations, when we're dealing with only routine immunizations. And I don't think the issue here is at all that there shouldn't be some right of health authorities to regulate and control matter. Or please speak to this, Greg. But, I mean, I think the issue here is about whether or not the authority is overreaching, not that there shouldn't be any authority at all, but maybe you could take just a quick moment to clarify that point for us and then go on.
Yeah, the traditional police powers and traditional public health authorities are already there. And, you know, a new proposed law isn't going to change that. So the authority is already in place. But what this proposed law does is it specifies the breadth of the authority. It's saying that if you resist a vaccination, according to the vaccination schedule, proposed by the board, by your local board, then you can be quarantined or isolated. Now, that's a very stark proposition because it rejects the idea of an exemption, you know, on the grounds of religion or philosophy or medical. It's saying that if you resist a vaccination, then you can be subject to quarantine or isolation. It's within their power is what they're saying, and they're making it explicit by statute. And now, even worse than that, I found something even worse than that, and this, you know, because there's obviously a difference between forced vaccination and forced medical treatment. So once you are determined to have an infectious disease that presents a, quote, significant risk, close quote, to the public, then you can be subject to a forced medical treatment. And that is regardless. And there's no provision in this proposed law that says that you can reject the proposed medical treatment. The forced medical treatment, and then be put into quarantine isolation. They just say, you get it. You get the forced medical treatment because they've determined that you present a significant risk. And the only protection that I've seen in this entire law regarding that is in the last section regarding procedural due process. Apparently, you can get a hearing to determine the status of your rights under the Act, but it's unclear whether they could do the procedure before the hearing.
I have there's some questions in the chat.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. I'm going to skip the first one, and I have two other ones. One is there a definition of a medical examination? And then number two, if there was to be a nuclear attack, why is it bad for the federal government to declare a true emergency and seize resources for the betterment of all? Vaccinations are only a small part of this equation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And also, you know, he also asks to define, it seems the problem is the definition of a true emergency. So they're all a complex network of questions that one relies upon the other. It's sort of like a domino thing of what is a true emergency and who's declaring it, and then isn't it better to protect the people for that? And the vaccinations are only a small part of this whole equation. And then the definition of a medical examination. So are all of these things laid out in the law?
Well, and if I could add a point to help maybe help focus the question is that I think a part of the problem, Greg, and I would absolutely love to hear your, you know, any comments or clarification on this, is maybe the breadth or possibly even ambiguity of some of these terms and who gets to decide what they mean if there's discretion, a discretionary call. And within that, risk for however good the intentions may be of any given individual at any given time, the potential for misuse or abuse because of how broad some of these terms and concepts really are. But please speak to that.
I definitely appreciate the concern of the commenter regarding if there were a nuclear emergency, what's the danger in giving power to the federal government, because someone has to have the power and there obviously needs to be some response. I would just caution that the sustainable responses of local individuals to meet the needs of other local individuals tend to be more like natural and holistic, whereas the responses of the federal government today are more like quarantine, you know, medical procedures, and things of that nature. It's like, it's very very standardized. It's kind of like treating people like cattle in a way.
Rigid in its thinking, perhaps? Is that part of what you're saying? Just very narrow in concept? Or you know, because one of the big problems with vaccines generally is the policies influenced by pharmaceutical industry who has a contrary agenda, a contrary desire, for, you know, a desire that's in conflict with the individuals in society, and to one extent or another that seems to go on in government at all levels, and perhaps more so at the federal than state levels. There may be some who would disagree with that in some states, but to what extent can we even get a neutral application, you know, treatment to an emergency, let alone a fully informed one that would encompass all of the legitimate possibilities.
Mm. Yeah, I'd add also that if I were an indoctrinated individual and I, you know, believe that there wasn't, you know, any sinister things going on behind the scenes and everything is as it should be and, you know, the medical community is here to help us and the federal government isn't trying to overreach its power, they're not, you know, actively seeking war, you know, then I might like this law. You know, I'd be, you know, raising my flag and supporting the troops and, you know, let's bomb Iran, all that. But I think I'm seeing beyond that, and I think people should too. And regarding the definition of examination, that was one of the questions. It's defined as diagnostic or investigative analyses or medical procedures that determine the presence or absence of or exposure to a condition of public health importance or its precursor to an individual. And then the definition of public health emergency, that was the second question. That means an occurrence or imminent threat of an illness or health condition that, and then it goes into all these categories like bioterrorism, biological toxin, and then certain of these categories are also defined. So it's obviously very well stated.
As on the local level, it sounded like, Alan, you were implying, or maybe it was Greg, you were implying that at the local level, since you're dealing with individuals, you can go case by case and say, really have a close examination of what's going on and maybe quarantine a person or a family, or maybe do some other kind of holistic type of a treatment that would alleviate the problem. I'm just making a metaphor for the way that the government is going to react or respond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, when it comes to quarantine and isolation, they have a whole section on that, and it talks about how the individual may, but it is not that's not necessarily must be allowed to self quarantine on private property. The proposed law provides provisions that give the power to the government to specify where you can quarantine, and so that can either be private property or public health. And that's all supposed to be in their plan. So it's a draftee's plan.
Mm-hmm.
And the isolated individual has to be tested regularly for the contagious disease that they may or may not have. And you know, little bits of lip service is paid to religious beliefs. Like it says that to the extent possible, cultural and religious beliefs shall be respected in addressing the needs of individuals and in maintaining isolation and quarantine premises.
And I'd like to also...
Allow,
I'm sorry. I wanted to note that we did have a show previously with Alan regarding the anthrax and why we would also want to just do a broad spectrum coverage of vaccine for something that is so minute as a possibility, and it's not even a contagious disease. So if anybody wants to listen to one of the archive shows.
Yeah.
Well, what we see in most current state emergency health laws, the ones I've looked at anyway, is that oftentimes the religious and philosophical exemptions go out the window in an emergency. And I don't think we've ever had an absolute right to a religious exemption, for example, or a philosophical exemption to immunizations in this country. It's always been, at least potentially, depending on the extent to which states want to assume the power by putting, including it in the wording of their respective laws, but they've always had the right, more or less, to say, yes, you can refuse vaccines for religious exemptions until we say otherwise. You know, oops, never mind, there's a local outbreak or there's an emergency and so forth. And I know that the officials here in North Carolina, and I expect most, if not all other states, would say the same thing. They say, well, we're going to, in any hypothetical future emergency, we're going to use the least restrictive means possible to deal with whatever the issue is. I think probably most state health officials are sensitive to the needs and preferences of their citizens to one degree or another, but they seem to be, anyway, when I was speaking with them here in North Carolina, to say, yes, we're going to use the least restrictive means. The concern for me was not so much about their intent, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt on that, as it was that when there's an emergency, people become afraid and they act in ways that may not be proportional to the actual level of the emergency. And the swine flu pandemic is such a beautiful example of that, because we now know there really was no pandemic. And when I was talking to North Carolina, the health director and their lead attorney, about our wishes to have exemption rights during an emergency here in North Carolina, they said to us, oh, well, that's already our policy. We're not concerned about people who wouldn't want the exemption. We're concerned about the chaos and problems from everybody wanting to get the vaccine, you know, all at once. And it was sort of funny, because I've been so focused on exemption and waiver rights that I hadn't thought about the other side of it. But the point is this, that while they can say their intent is to take the least restrictive means available, and we would never, you know, pull people out of their homes and throw them into a facility unless there was just some terrible, awful circumstance that just absolutely required it. That's sort of the underlying implication. Well, we now know from recent example that people's perceptions and their actions are based on their perceptions. The perceptions can be grossly disproportionate to what's really going on, whether it be the deliberate intent of someone at some level to misrepresent reality or not. And so when the overreaching authority is there, it's no comfort to me when my health authorities say, well, we're not going to really ever use that unless we just absolutely had to and there was, you know, just literally no other choice. I'm not comforted by that, because I feel like if the authority's there, whatever authority is there could potentially be overstepped. And we see in the vaccine arena this happen all the time, and I could give examples if you'd like, but The last thing I want to do is have extra authority just in case we need it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and to add to that point, Alan, which is really, really well stated, on the point about least restrictive means, that provision is actually in this Model Act too. And there's something sinister going on behind the scenes here. And you kind of have to understand constitutional law to get what's going on here. But the reason they put that in, that least restrictive means, which basically says that the state will employ the least restrictive alternative in interpreting the law, so that, especially regarding compulsory powers, that means that if the agency is going to exercise one of its powers, then it will, to the extent it can, employ a policy that infringes the least on the rights of individuals. And they put a little clause like that in the law, not because they're really planning on respecting your individual rights, but just so that it doesn't get attacked, that, that the law doesn't get challenged in court.
So that it can withstand constitutional scrutiny.
And this dissuades a wholesale. And you got to understand that by dissuading a whole-scale preemptive attack on the law, it means that the only time you can challenge this law is in its practical effect. That means that there has to already be an emergency going on, and then you have to sue. And you know how long it takes to get to the Supreme Court? A long time. Year. And so
a little longer than it takes to get quarantined.
Violation of all these individual rights are going on, and you're in a fear state, like Alan was talking about, then you see that this little clause, you know, oh, well, we're going to use the least restrictive means, you know, it's just paying lip service. It's just something that they threw in because they had to. And like, and then they throw in other little things. Like if they really wanted to protect your individual rights, they would say, you have the right to self-quarantine on your property. You have the right to a naturopathic doctor, you know, who can, provide you access to, you know, natural remedies. You know, that's individual rights. What they do is they just say, and you find the same sort of stuff at the UN. You know, it's like, oh, we're going to respect, this is a quote, respect for the dignity of each individual, close quote. What does that mean?
It means nothing, really, because it's,
it's lip service. How do you enforce that? You know, I'm your lawyer. I'm going to go into court, and I'm going to include a clause in my complaint that says the government is not showing, quote, respect for the dignity of this individual. You know, what's that going to get? The judge is going to laugh at that. It means nothing. And yet it being in this law allows them, on the flip side, allows the government to claim to defend the law that the law has a provision that respects, you know, that is providing the least restrictive alternative. So there can't be a wholesale attack. So, I mean, sure, I could try to use that provision, but it's not like an operative provision that by itself would allow me to prove a violation of due process or a violation of privacy or something like that. It's just in there.
Right. So when you say an operative provision, you're talking about something that is actually tangible and specific objective that you can state, they didn't let me do such and such, or we're allowed to take these specific steps. But when it is in a more philosophical, I love your neighbor, or dignity, for what does that mean? Pete, that's a subject to so much interpretation, or you cannot enforce it in any way. It makes it much more difficult. We have about 20-something minutes left, and I thought you might want to go back to the specific article and talk about this loophole that the government has a little bit more and why it pertains to children specifically.
Sure. Yeah. I was lucky enough to have published on naturalnews.com an article that I wrote recently. And the essence of the article focuses on a loophole that I discovered in reading vaccine laws throughout the nation. And what I found is that during times of peace, you can live your life in a way that means that you won't have to get vaccinated. And I'm going to throw some major qualifications on that, and Alan's going to help me out here. But you may have to move. You know, you may have to move to a new city to avoid being vaccinated. You may have to, not have your kids in public school or even private school. You may have to not have government employment. You may not be able to work in healthcare. But there is a way for you to avoid vaccines during peacetime. That's been the historical historical fact in our nation. No state has ever had statewide mandatory vaccination. Now, when it comes to emergencies and pandemics, we get into a whole different realm, because then the emergency powers are heightened. And that's, you know, we were just talking about that with this Model Act. And so there's a loophole here. It's that if you are asserting an exemption to a vaccine, you know, whether it's on religious grounds or medical grounds, then, as I've stated, one of the powers of the state is to put you in isolation or quarantine to, quote, you know, protect the public, right? And so, but once you're in isolation and quarantine, you're like a prisoner. And so you can lose the legal guardianship of your children. And I say legal guardianship because it's more like shared guardianship that you have. So you can assert some rights, but not all. And one of the provisions that I found in the California Welfare and Institutions Code relates to putting a child into the care of a family member, you know, willing to care for that person. And they're allowed to make, you know, reasonable decisions for that person's well-being because they, you know, they're living with the child. They have access to the most current information and so forth. So they can take the child to the doctor and get the child vaccinated. And so that's the loophole. It's that once you're a ward of the state, you know, once you resist vaccination, you're put into quarantine, there's no guarantee that your child, that you can exert the exemption of your child. And to close this loophole is there needs to be some law at the state level that says that parents who are in quarantine or isolation, and that can include self-quarantine, do not lose their fundamental parental rights to assert their child's vaccine exemption, and that during a declared emergency, families should be able to self-quarantine together, all together, on their private property until they're cleared to leave by the family's medical doctor or naturopathic practitioner. And I think that would strike the balance between public health and individual rights.
Is there somebody who's going to try to change this into a law?
Well, this becomes another agenda item. I'll tell you, on my vaccinerights.com website, I have a list of over a dozen vaccine rights agenda items, legislative agenda items, and this is, you know, another one for that list. It should become, and I would say probably most of those dozen items apply to most states, is my general belief at this point. I'll put it that way. And this would be another one for that list. And it's interesting, as I'm listening to you, Greg, and I didn't think about this earlier when I was first reading your article, but there is some related legal precedent that maybe gives us a little bit of insight by way of close analogy, I think, here as to how this might be the sort of thing that could vary state to state. I'll give you a quick example. There was a case here in North Carolina in recent years where parents had lost custody of their children to the state, but they had not yet had their parental rights terminated. And the exemption law, and the laws vary, the specific wording varies from state to state, but the religious exemption law here in North Carolina refers to the parent, guardian, or person in loco parentis, which is just Latin legalese for person in or entity in the position of a parent. Well, in this particular case, when the parents had lost custody of their children to the state, there were some, I think, neglect issues with the family and some relatively serious ones. But the bottom line is the parents wanted to exercise religious exemption over their children, and this went up on appeal in the state courts here in North Carolina, and the appellate court said, nope, you know, you lost custody of your children to the state. The state was then in loco parentis. They were in the position of the parent, and they got to decide whether or not the children got vaccinated. However, there was a similar case in, I think it was Arizona, several years ago, where the parent in a similar situation was deemed by the appellate court there to still retain control over the religion of the child and to exercise religious exemption. So it's an interesting issue. Now, that's a different situation than isolation or quarantine, but I bet it's a close enough relationship that it gives us some insight. But bottom line, especially the case here in North Carolina, really underscores your point, and it's one that had never occurred to me, so I was delighted to see your article and have you bring this this issue to light, because it's absolutely something that should become a legislative agenda item as we're seeking rights and clarification in the law.
Yeah. I think we need to have a new law on this. You know, even the Supreme Court, in the case of Heller v. Doe, this was in 1993, also mentioned the same rule that you're talking about there, Alan. It's that the parent's patriae power, you know, in loco parentis, it's the same Latin, is the power of the state to serve as guardian of persons under legal disability, and that includes juveniles, you know, or the insane. In the Heller case, it was a case of civil commitment for mental illness. And, yeah, what they said is that the state has a legitimate interest under its parens patriae powers in providing care to its citizens who are unable to care for themselves. And so in an emergency, what I found is that in reading these, you know, quarantine, isolation rules, is that they if you're in quarantine and isolation, they will either take your kid and put them in the custody of a family member who's willing to, you know, get along, go along, or they'll just take the kids into state control.
And
so
that's
a major loophole in the law, because as is this forced medical procedure. I mean, these rules should be so unconstitutional on the grounds that they can't force you to be unnatural. If you're a peaceful and innocent human being and you haven't committed a crime, they can't make it a crime for you to refuse medical treatment. You know, there's perhaps a tenable ground that they have, and under the fundamental rule, and this predates America, of the right of self-defense, where if you are presenting a significant risk, in like a material, an imminent threat to another individual, then that individual is allowed to defend themselves and take reasonable cautions. And so is a forced medical procedure a reasonable self-defense action in response to a, you know, in response to the, you know, quote, contagious threat? Well, that would be something that could be determined by a review board. And in an emergency situation, it would be determined by basically what is a military tribunal. You know, some public health authority. I mean, you're basically going before public health authority. Job it is to enforce these emergency laws, and you're saying, hey, you guys aren't allowed to enforce these laws against me, that, you know, we're from which you derive all of your power, all of your funding. It's like a kangaroo court, right?
Right, right. Because it seems no matter how you slice this and how detailed the laws and definitions may be, that ultimately you're going to have discretionary calls, and that discretion is being put in the hands of people who certainly, with regard to the larger vaccine controversy and as it pertains to vaccines, arguably are exercising their discretion more likely than not on incomplete information. You know, and all of these different issues, to one degree or another, have underlying them the concerns about the ability of government, perhaps at all levels, to function neutrally and objectively and effectively. And that, of course, is seriously brought into question in this arena, in my opinion, by anybody who takes a serious look beneath the surface of vaccine policy and law to see what really drives it, and become aware of the inherent problems in that whole issue. But
Alan and Greg, it feels to me that it's a part of the question or the reasoning of government to protect the people. This is the reason they say they want to do this. And I can understand that what they're afraid of are persons who perhaps have an evil intent, or who don't,
or just out of ignorance or inability.
I'm trying to think of some examples. Like, let's say somebody has HIV and they go around having sexual relations with a lot of people and passing this contagious disease on just because they have it and they're angry and, you know, they're mad and they want other people to know what it feels like, or because they're mentally deranged, or because the disease has made them internally, this contagious disease wants to pass itself along, and it survives through these types of contacts. Or there's a person who comes on an airplane and they have gotten influenza or some other contagious disease. They don't know that they have it. They're at the initial stages where they're most contagious. They have a fever or whatever. They're sneezing. And now this person is spreading the disease around. So the government, it supposedly wants to protect the rest of the people. And in order to do that, these are the steps that they're taking. So, I mean, I understand their thinking, and I agree that we need to protect the majority of the population. But in doing so, we are losing a greater majority in terms of parents who are sensitive to the needs of their own children and want to take a different approach to health and healing. Do you understand my question?
Sure. All of these issues have to do with not one extreme or another, but where do you draw the lines? Who gets to make the decisions under what circumstances? Because we have, you know, the sort of classic non-emergency situation where a child has some sort of potentially fatal chronic disease, and the parents want to do an alternative form of treatment, and if it ends up in court, you'll most often see the court enforcing mainstream medical approach, which there's some really good evidence at this point to suggest that in some situations that's not going to be the best care. And who gets to decide? I'll speak for myself. I want my government to be able to jump in and save a child's life or save a child from unnecessary harm if the parents, for some reason, are not able to do that, you know, for reason of mental illness or what have you. But, again, it becomes a question of when is the government overreaching? When are they, you know, and people in the position of government understandably are going to want to be on the better safe than sorry. And so they're, from their point of view, they're going to want to risk overreaching rather than risk underreaching and not helping people that they might have otherwise been able to help. So it is even with regard to those who do have honest integrity and the best intentions, it's an inherently problematic discussion about where you draw the lines. It becomes even more problematic, though, when you recognize that some of the forces driving the overreaching are not ones with integrity. Greg, what do you want to throw into that?
Right. It's the rights of the many as opposed to the rights of the few. To me, that's what it sounds like. Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, sure. You know, there's according to my research, a massive genocidal campaign going on in the world, and it would be folly to presume that the Nazism that occurred in Germany during World War II and before it ended at the end of World War II, that the eugenics movement is no longer in existence. My research shows exactly the opposite. It's just been restated, reclassified,
and repackaged.
repackaged for the new generation. And the public health authorities today probably think, most public health authorities today think that they're, you know, helping people by promoting, you know, advanced medicine and so forth, but not knowing that they are contributing not just to the violation of individual rights, but actually to the fall of a nation. And because play it out in your head. You know, so you have a bioterrorism event, okay, and this causes a massive upheaval not only of individual rights but also of the economy, and it reformulates the economy in a way that the businesses that are able to continue to make money are the ones taking federal grants to provide necessary services. This is where you get into the private-public cooperation, also known as fascism, and when you have a sustained pandemic, sustained fear, and an ongoing threat, then you have a vested interest, just like we saw with the military-industrial complex. You know, it never ended. Once it got going, it just never ended. And it sustained perpetual war, you know, whether it was – and even when there wasn't wars, they at least had arms races going on, you know. There was always a reason to just keep it going, and that is the danger of consolidating power. And then eventually – when you have a system of mounting debt and an unsustainable infrastructure, your system crashes, and that is where the current path is heading. And in the process of that path, some of the worst individual violations are going to take place. And we already know this is part of man's predisposition for the zealous pursuit of undeserved power. And
you're not speculating. We've seen this over and over again, haven't we?
Yeah.
And I would recommend people listen to yesterday's PBS with Diane Rehm, she was talking about the rewording of population control to better parenting or better family planning.
Right.
So yeah. That is another way of rephrasing a similar type of activity to sound very popular or good for you. So
yeah.
Go ahead with the mounting debt and systems crashing and we're heading on
right.
this path. Okay.
Yeah, it's a path of destruction and it's a path built on the road of hypocrisy where, you know, public health is actually public destruction and, you know, truth is falsity, et cetera, et cetera. You know, war is peace. And in order to restructure that thinking, one has to first answer the moral questions of, you know, what is the proper way to approach sustainable living and to love your neighbor? And once you answer that question, you realize that you're not going to forcibly stick a needle into your neighbor. You know,
mm-hmm.
you're going to promote natural health remedies, and it just takes a little bit of research, maybe even a month, you know, to really just figure out what's actually going on in the world. And now, and yet there's also so much propaganda that comes from the independent media as well, that it's not going to be this you may find in pursuing this research that there's not one organization, you know, that has it just nailed. You know, you have to be an independent thinker and you have to be willing to accept that you're going to be fooled on both sides, mainstream news and in indie news. And the rational course is just to humble yourself and try to be a provider of things that are sustainable for others, and keep your ears open and try not to hurt anyone. And in the process of doing that, if you find that you are promoting businesses that are unsustainable, purchasing fast food, injecting yourself with things and pursuing a path of pharmaceutical medication and being angry and things like that, you're probably on the wrong course. You know, the path of peace is so it's so simple and humble, and it's not followed by the American government. And so to give them whole scale power over the individual rights of people so that you can't realistically pursue that path of peace. You know, like imagine that they took away your right to live on a homestead and raise a family and animals and homeschool your children and pursue natural remedies. You know, they're saying that there's this like one size fits all and you have to be an American in this particular way and come and line up for your needle. You know, that was the beginning. That was the first step of Nazism. Remember? They put the star on everybody. You know, that's like the vaccine. You know, it is this symbol. You know, even if from my research, you know, the vaccine, it will definitely harm your immune system. It is terrible. But, you know, you can take it and live. And it's like that star, you know, you'll live, you know, for a little while, but eventually it gets worse.
I'm going to just like chime in here. I don't think we're going to make that analogy because the star was a very specific thing for a particular people to eliminate them from the world. So let's not go there. Let's think of some other kind of analogy where the vaccine is another kind of a symbol.
Well, let me jump in here with a quick comment. I think Greg's point, in a broader sense, is that this is what's going on in the vaccine arena and elsewhere. But for our purposes, the vaccine arena is a multifaceted, aggressive front that is moving on several different levels and places. And we've talked about this in other shows recently. But just a quick recap. People going door to door in California to give vaccines to students who are not, you know, who haven't been vaccinated, or the University of Chicago mailing and calling people asking about their immunization records, or entirely new categories of employers now requiring their employees to have vaccines as a condition of employment. New state laws being passed that allow children to consent to vaccines, or restricting access to exemptions, if not eliminating exemptions altogether. And of course, the emergency Model Health Powers Act and the states that have enacted, most states, one part or more of that Model Act, and having more aggressive and overreaching authority that they're giving themselves. All of these things taken together are part of a very aggressive and multifaceted front that is moving, that seems to have no real end goal, short of falling apart when our nation falls apart, if that's what happens. We should be very concerned about all of this. We should be looking for ways to become legislatively active. And I think, Greg, maybe your article refers to that, but I don't specifically recall. But the National Vaccine Information Center's advocacy portal is one place to do that, and the Pandemic Response Project perhaps as well. But we, in whatever way works for each of us as individuals, we need to become legislatively active, because the machine is rolling forward. It's not something we can sit by passively and hope it'll fix itself, because I don't believe it will. Greg, you have any comments you want to add to that?
Well, we're ending in about a minute, so I
wrap it up in a minute then.
Yeah, I would definitely invite legislative activity to address the underlying problem, which is the zealous pursuit of undeserved power. If we can fix that, then the vaccine issue fixes itself.
Okay, I want to thank both of you today for being on the show. It was really enlightening and makes us think about what's going to happen to our future, and we must act. You can contact Greg Glaser at, just name your website or your contact.
CivilActionNetwork.org.
And Alan, you're on pandemicresponse.com?
Yeah, and vaccinerights.com. And I just want to real quick thank Greg. Greg does just incredibly meticulous research on these issues. And Greg, let's get you back and get those other 8 or 9 points on the table for discussion, too. There's so much here. Let's follow up. And thanks so much for being here with us today. It's
thank you.
Been enlightening as always.
Okay, and next up is Dr. Christina Chambro with Pet Health and Homeopathy. If you have an animal in need of help, she will take a live case today, hopefully. So we'll see what she says. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate. But now we know.